Chapter 12. If God does not exist, how do you explain all the suffering of the poor? The sad story of Nejip and Hijran. On leaving His Excellency's lodge, Carr headed back to the hotel, and as he trudged through the snow, his mind turned to Ipek. It wouldn't be long, he realized, before he'd see her again. On his way down Halit Pasha Avenue, he passed first a group of People's Party campaigners, and then a crowd of students on their way out of a university entrance exam course. The students were talking about what they were going to watch on television that night, and about how easy it was to fool their chemistry teacher. They were needling each other, just as mercilessly as Carr and I used to do when we were their age. Carr saw a mother and father leading their tearful child by the hand from an apartment building where they'd just visited the dentist upstairs. It was clear from their clothes that this couple were barely making ends meet, but they had decided to take their beloved child not to the state dispensary, but rather to a private dentist, whose treatment they hoped would be less painful. Through the open door of a shop that sold women's stockings, bolts of cotton cloth, colored pencils, batteries, and cassettes, he heard once again the strains of Peppino di Capri's Roberta, and remembered hearing it on the radio when he was a child and his uncle had taken him out for a drive on the Bosphorus. As his heart began to soar, it occurred to Carr that there might be a new poem coming to him. So he stepped into the first tea house he could find and, sitting down at the first empty table, took out his pencil and his notebook. After gazing through moist eyes at the empty page for some time, he revised his forecast. Actually, there was no poem coming to him, but this didn't dampen his spirits in the slightest. The tea house was packed with unemployed men and students, and all around him the walls were plastered not just with scenes of Switzerland, but also with theatrical posters, newspaper cartoons, assorted clippings, an announcement of the terms and conditions of the civil service exam, and a schedule of the soccer matches to be played by Karspor that year. The results of past matches, most of them losses, were penciled in by various hands. Next to the 6-1 loss to Erzurumspor, someone had written the lines that Karr would incorporate into All Humanity and the Stars, the poem he would write tomorrow while sitting in the Lucky Brothers tea house. Even if your mother came down from heaven to take you into her arms, even if your wicked father let her go without a beating for just one night, you'd still be penniless, your shit would still freeze, your soul would still wither. There is no hope. If you're unlucky enough to live in Kars, you might as well flush yourself down the toilet. Smiling happily as he copied these lines into his notebook, he was soon joined by Nejip, who was sitting at a table in the back. It was clear from his expression that he was stunned to see Carr in this place, and also very pleased.
"I'm so happy you're here," said Nejip. "Are you writing a poem?"
"I would like to apologize for my friends, especially the one who called you an atheist. It's the first time in their lives they've come face to face with a non-believer.
But it seems to me that you couldn't really be an atheist because you're such a good person."
He went on to say a few other things that he'd felt unable to say earlier. He and his friends had sneaked out of school to attend the show at the theater that evening, but they were going to sit way in the back because, of course, they didn't want the school directors to spot them on live TV. Nejip was elated to have escaped from school and to be meeting his friends at the National Theater. They all knew that Carr was going to read a poem there. Everyone in Kars wrote poems, but Carr was the first person Nejip had ever met to have his poems published. Could he offer Carr a glass of tea? Carr explained that he was short of time.
"In that case, I'll just ask you one question, one last question," said Nejip. "I'm not like my friends. I'm not trying to show you disrespect. I'm just very curious."
"Yes." Nejip lit a cigarette with shaky hands.
"If God does not exist, that means heaven does not exist either. And that means the world's poor, those millions who live in poverty and oppression, will never go to heaven. And if that is so, then how do you explain all the suffering of the poor? What are we here for?
And why do we put up with so much unhappiness if it's all for nothing?
God exists. So does heaven.
No, you're just saying that to console me because you feel sorry for us. As soon as you're back in Germany, you'll start thinking God doesn't exist, just like you did before.
For the first time in years, I'm very happy, said Carr. Why shouldn't I believe the same things as you?
Because you belong to the intelligentsia, said Nedjib. People in the intelligentsia never believe in God. They believe in what Europeans do, and they think they're better than ordinary people.
I may belong to the intelligentsia in Turkey, said Carr. But in Germany, I'm a worthless nobody. I was falling apart there.
Nedjib's beautiful eyes turned inward, and Carr could see that the teenager was considering his case, trying to put himself in Carr's shoes.
Then why did you get angry at your country and flee to Germany?
He asked.
Seeing Carr's face fall, he said,
Never mind. Anyway, if I were rich,
I'd be so ashamed of my situation that I'd believe in God even more. One day, God willing, we'll all be rich, said Carr.
Nothing is as simple as you say. That's what I think. I'm not that simple either, and I don't want to be rich. What I want is to be a writer. I'm writing a science fiction novel. It might get published in one of the Carr's papers, the one called The Lance, but I don't want to be published in a paper that sells 75 copies. I want to be published in an Istanbul paper that sells thousands. I have a synopsis of the novel with me. If I read it to you, could you tell me whether you think an Istanbul paper might publish it?
Carr looked at his watch.
It's very short, said Nedjib.
The electricity went out, and all of Carr's was plunged into darkness. The only light in the tea house was coming from the stove. Nedjib ran over to the counter and grabbed a candle. He lit it and dripped a few drops of wax onto a plate, a seal by which to affix the burning candle to the plate, which he set on the table. Retrieving a few sheets of crumpled paper from his pocket, he began to read in a hesitant voice, stopping from time to time to gulp with excitement.
In the year 3579, there was a red planet we haven't even discovered yet. Its name was Ghazali, and its people were rich, and their lives were much easier than our lives are today. But contrary to what materialists would have predicted, their rich and easy lives did not bring the inhabitants of this planet any spiritual satisfaction. To the contrary, everyone was deeply anxious about being and nothingness, man and the universe, God and his people. And so it came to pass that a number of Ghazalians traveled to the most remote corner of their planet to set up the Islamic Lycée for the study of science and oration. It took only the cleverest and most hard-working students. Two close friends attended this lycée, inspired by books written 1,600 years earlier, books that illuminated this East-West problem so beautifully they could have been written yesterday. They called each other Nedjib and Fazl. Together they read The Great East, their revered master's finest book, over and over, and in the evenings they would meet secretly in Fazl's bed, the higher bunk, where under the covers they would lie side by side, watching the blue snowflakes fall onto the glass roof above them and disappear, just like planets. Here they would whisper into each other's ears about the meaning of life and the things they hoped to do when they were older. The evil-hearted tried in vain to tarnish this pure friendship with snide and jealous jokes. But then, one day, the two came under a cloud. It so happened that they had simultaneously fallen in love with the same girl, a virgin named Hijran. Even when they discovered that Hijran's father was an atheist, they couldn't cure themselves of their hopeless longing. On the contrary, their love grew all the more intense. In this way, they came to realize that there was no longer enough room on Ghazali for both of them. They knew in their hearts that one of them would have to die, but they made the following promise. After spending some time in the next world, no matter how many light years away it was, the one who died would come back to this world to visit his surviving friend and answer his most urgent questions about life after death. As for the question of who would kill whom and how it would be done, They just couldn't make up their minds, mainly because they both knew that true happiness could only come for the one who sacrificed his own life for the other. So, for example, if one of them, let's say it was Fazl, said, "Let's both stick our naked hands into the sockets at the same time and electrocute ourselves together," Necip would see it at once for what it was. A clever trick Fazl had invented to sacrifice himself for his friend. Clearly Fazl would have arranged for Necip's socket to be harmless. After many months of hemming and hawing, months that caused both boys great pain, the question was decided in a matter of seconds. Necip returned from his evening lessons one night to discover his dear friend lying dead in his bed, riddled with bullets. The following year, Necip married Hijran, and on their wedding night he told her what had passed between him and his friend, and how one day Fazl would return from the spirit world. Hijran told him she had really loved Fazl. After his death, she had cried for days, cried so much that blood had run from her eyes, and she had married Necip only because he was Fazl's friend and bore him some resemblance. They decided not to consummate their marriage and agreed that the ban on love should continue until Fazl returned from the other world. But as the years passed, they began to long for each other. First, their longing was spiritual, and then it became physical. One night during an interplanetary inspection, while shining their beams on a city on Earth that went by the name of Kars, they were no longer able to control themselves. They fell upon each other like crazy people and made passionate love. You might think this meant they had forgotten Fazl, whose memory had for so long plagued them like a toothache. But they had not forgotten him, and the shame in their hearts scared them as it grew with every day. A night arrived when they awoke suddenly, having both decided at the same time that this strange cocktail of fear and other emotions was going to destroy them. At the same moment, the television across the room turned on by itself, and there, shining brightly, the ghostly form of Fazl took shape. The deadly shots to the forehead were still fresh, and his lower lip and other wounds were still dripping with blood. "I am racked with pain," said Fazl. "There is not a single corner of the other world I have not seen. I will write about these travels in full detail, using Ghazali's Victories of Mecca and Ibn Arabi as my inspirations," said Necip. "I have earned the highest compliments of God's angels, and I have traveled to what is thought to be the summit of the highest plane of heaven. I have seen the terrible punishments meted out in hell to tie-wearing atheists and arrogant colonialist positivists who make fun of the common people and their faith. But everywhere happiness eluded me because my mind was here with you." Husband and wife were overwhelmed with fearful admiration as they listened to the sad ghost. "The thing that made me so unhappy all those years was not the thought that I might one day see you two sitting so happily together as I am seeing you tonight. On the contrary, I longed for Necip's happiness more than I longed for my own. Because of the profound feeling between us, we had been unable to find any way to kill either ourselves or each other. Because each valued the other's life more than his own, it was as if we were both wearing protective armor that made us immortal. How happy that made me feel. But my death proved to me that I had been wrong to believe in this feeling." "No," Necip cried. "Not once did I give my own life more value than I gave to yours." "If this had been true, I never would have died," said Fazl's ghost. "And you would never have married the beautiful Hijran. I died because you harbored a secret wish, a wish so secret you even hid it from yourself. To see me dead." Necip objected violently to this accusation, but the ghost refused to listen. "It was not just the suspicion that you wished me dead that deprived me of peace in the other world," said the ghost. "It was also that you had a hand in my murder, for it was you who so treacherously shot me in the head, and here, as I lay in my bed sleeping. And there was another fear, too, the fear that you acted as an agent for the enemies of the Holy Quran." By now, Necip had given up objecting and fallen silent. There is only one way for you to deliver me from my suffering and restore me to heaven, and only by following this same path can you deliver yourself from suspicion in this heinous crime," said the ghost. "Find my killer, whoever he might be. In 7 years and 7 months they haven't found a single suspect. And when you've found whoever killed me or wanted me dead, I want to see the crime avenged. An eye for an eye. So long as that villain remains unpunished, there is no peace for me in this life, nor will there be any peace for you in the transitory realm that you still insist on calling the real world." Neither Nejip nor Hijran could think what to say. They watched in tearful amazement as the ghost vanished from the screen.
"And then what?
What happened next?" Kaa asked.
"I haven't decided yet," said Nejip. "But if I wrote the whole story, do you think I could sell it?"
When he saw Kaa hesitating, he added,
"Listen, every line I write comes from the bottom of my heart. They all express my deepest convictions.
What does this story mean to you? What did you feel when I was reading it to you?"
"It shook me to the core, because it showed me that you believe with all your heart that this world is nothing more than a preparation for the next."
"Yes, I do believe that," said Nejip with excitement. "It's not enough, though. God wants us to be happy in this world, too. But that's the hardest thing."
They fell silent as they pondered the hardest thing. After a moment, the lights came back on, but the people in the tea house remained as silent as they had been in the darkness, and the television screen was still dark. The owner began to hit it with his fist.
"We've been sitting here together for 20 minutes now," said Nejip. "My friends must be dying of curiosity."
"Who are your friends?" asked Kaa. "Is one of them Fazl? And are those your real names?"
"No, of course not. I'm using an assumed name, just like the Nejip in the story."
"You're not a policeman. Stop interrogating me."
"As for Fazl, he refuses to come to places like this," Nejip told him, turning quite mysterious.
"Fazl is the most religious person in our group, and he's the person I trust more than anyone else in the world. But he's worried that if he gets involved in politics, he'll get a police file and be kicked out of school. He has an uncle in Germany who's going to send for him, and we love each other just as much as the two boys in the story. So, if someone killed me, I'm certain that he would take revenge. In fact, it's just as in the story. We're so close that no matter how far apart we are, we can always tell what the other is doing."
"So, what's Fazl doing right now?"
Said Nejip, assuming a strange pose. "He's in the dormitory, reading."
"Who is Hijran?"
"That's not a real name either. But it's not a name she took herself, it's a name we've given her. Some of us write her love letters and poems non-stop, but we're too afraid to send them. If I had a daughter, I'd want her to be as beautiful, as intelligent, and as courageous as she is. She's the leader of the Headscarf Girls, and she's afraid of nothing. Her mind is her own. To tell you the truth, in the beginning she was an infidel. This was because she was under the influence of her atheist father. She was a model in Istanbul. She'd go on television and bare her bottom and flaunt her legs. She came here to do a shampoo commercial for television. In it, she was going to be walking along Ahmed Mukhtar the Conqueror Avenue, the meanest, dirtiest street in Kars, but also the most beautiful. Then when she stopped in front of the camera, she was to swing her magnificent waist-length brown hair like a flag and say, 'Even in the filth of the beautiful city of Kars, my hair is still sparkling clean, thanks to Blendax.' The commercial was going to be shown everywhere. The whole world would laugh at us." At that time, the headscarf business at the Institute of Education was just getting started, and two of the girls had seen Hijran on television and also recognized her from photographs in gossip magazines that had reported on her behavior with rich kids in Istanbul. Secretly, the girls admired her, so they invited her for tea. Hijran accepted, though for her it was a big joke. She got bored with the girls almost immediately, and do you know what she said?
If our religion... No, she didn't say our religion. She said your religion. If your religion requires you to hide your hair and the state forbids you to wear a headscarf, why don't you be like so-and-so? Here she gave the name of a foreign rock star. And just shave your hair off and wear a nose ring. Then the whole world would stand up and take notice. Our poor girls were so taken aback to hear these affronts that they couldn't even keep from laughing with her. This made Hijran even bolder, so she said, "These scarves are sending you back to the Middle Ages. Why don't you take them off and flaunt your beautiful hair?" And as Hijran was about to remove the scarf from the silliest girl among them, her hand froze. Suddenly, Hijran threw herself at the silly girl's feet. The girl's brother is one of our classmates, and he's so stupid, even the morons call him a moron, and begged the girl's pardon. Hijran returned the next day, and the day after that. And in the end, she joined them instead of going back to Istanbul. She's one of the saints who'll help turn the headscarf into the flag of Anatolia's oppressed Muslim women. Mark my words. "Then why did you say nothing about her in your story except that she was a virgin?" asked Kar. "Why didn't Necip and Fazl ask for her opinion before deciding to kill themselves for her sake?" There was a tense silence, during which Necip raised his beautiful eyes, one of which, in 2 hours and 3 minutes, would be shattered by a bullet. He looked up at the dark street to watch the snow fall slowly, like a poem. Then he whispered, "There she is. It's her."
"Who?"
"Hijran. She's out there, in the street."